All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Beauty and the Beast Physical Therapy and Strength Conditioning Podcast. I am joined by my co-host, Dr. Ross Childs.
How's it going, everyone? Hope everyone's enjoying the sunny Wednesday, hopefully sunny Thursday by the time you guys hear this. It's Thanksgiving week, so super excited about that. It's really the one of the few days that I really do not care about what I put into my body. So I'm really looking forward to that. I've got a lot of family coming up, so it's going to be a giant shit show, but it's fun. That's what we live for. Any big plans for Thanksgiving, Adam?
No, we have kind of two Thanksgivings. We have one small one tomorrow, and then my fiance's family on Saturday. So I got to be a little bit careful to not completely demolish myself two different days, but I'm looking forward to it.
It'll be good. I mean, Thanksgiving to me is just a day to kind of family fun and football. That's what I always call it. So I always look forward to it. And generally, you know, nutrition-wise, from Thanksgiving to the New Year, I definitely give myself a lot of leeway this time of year. So slightly look forward to it, but you know, I don't overindulge too much, but enough about that. So we got some great feedback on the last couple of podcasts that we've been doing, and really we're trying to tie all the principles of training together, and today we're going to go over some specific principles. But over the course of the last 40-something podcasts, hopefully we've educated everyone on what a hip-dominant exercise is versus knee-dominant, power versus strength versus endurance versus mobility versus flexibility. And really we're looking at the overall themes of the principles of training. So there are four or five specific ones that we'll go over. And for anyone who's had an exercise science background, ex-phys background, even athletic training, you know, you've probably heard these before, and some of them are really common sense, just for the sake of conversation, but hopefully we'll dig into it a lot more. And the goal for Adam and I today is to really, you know, come full circle with everything that we've talked about. So we're going to be jumping all over the place like we normally do, but there's actually an agenda with this podcast today. So Adam and I will share our experiences with it, you know, and when we learned about these and how we implement them into our own training, but then also keeping it as simple as we can for you guys. So now, Adam, we talked right before we started recording, and you know, some of these principles that we've talked about, you know, we learned when we were in undergrad, and you know, we probably heard about them beforehand, but never really put two and two together. And they have multiple principles now. Because of the amount of experience you have and the knowledge that you have, do you ever really think about these principles anymore?
In the way that they're written out like this and different, no. But it's just so ingrained now that a lot of this stuff is built into whatever I'm doing for whoever.
Exactly.
Yeah, am I like, you know, getting a new client and I write down individuality, specificity, progression, overload, and then like define each how I'm going to do it for each person? Yeah. No, because 95% of that stuff is like, that's just how I program now, yeah. How I work with people, it's just second nature at this point.
Yeah. So I know everyone's now thinking, you know, what are these training principles? Because we just keep calling them by their overarching term. So just so that everyone's on the same page, the main training principles that we're talking about right now are the principles of specificity, the principles of overload and progression, the principles of reversibility, the fit principle, and then the individuality principle that Adam just alluded to. So we'll go through each one, and then we'll bring it back to how we define or how we include that in with periodization training, which we've talked about, which is different periods of block training. But you know, when we think of the individuality or individual difference principle, I think at this point, you and I, we don't have to think about it in that term, because we look at the individual athlete or the individual patient who's coming in, and we ask them their goal. What do you hope to accomplish?
Yeah.
You know, so for that, you know, just to give an example of that, for me, if I have someone who comes in that says, I need to get back to, say, CrossFit, you know, high intensity, maybe it's an overhead athlete with a shoulder problem, All right, it's a high-intensity athlete who needs to achieve overhead. So would it be beneficial to only do exercises below the shoulder and not work on strength? No. So I need to understand, you know, what my clientele is, what my patient population is, and that becomes super important. You know, and then when you're dealing with patients or clients, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, probably part of your intake is, you know, what are your goals? What do you hope to accomplish? You know, what sports do you play? What recreational activities do you like to play? And the individuality comes in, whether it's skiing or whether it's hiking, you know, gardening. If those are the individual activities that the person wants to perform, we then have to break it down on that individual basis. So, you know, that principle I feel is just second nature. You know, we don't necessarily have to think about that one, you know, because we're starting off right away getting to know the person. Now, there are cases where we have someone like a strength athlete who has only been focusing on, you know, 80 to 90% of their strength. Maybe they've dabbled in a little bit of power, and we think that they may do well with, you know, maybe some muscular endurance, something along those lines. So now we're changing up their training emphasis to provide that stimulus. But again, it's still with the individuality principle in mind to say, you are very strength dominant. We need to round you out by doing X. And in this case, it would be muscular endurance. So now, specificity, I also think, is another important one. It kind of goes with the individuality principle, I believe. Mm-hmm. But I think specificity fits perfectly in with periodization, because really we're looking at the specific adaptations to impose demands, the SED principle. So specificity, you want to be training specifically to what your sport is, but also whatever you're training, you're going to get that stimulus, which provides that adaptation. So this is what Adam and I have really talked a lot about when we deal with power and strength and endurance and agility. Those are the specific demands that we are imposing on the body. So this is where we come in and say, this is a strength athlete. This is going to be our strength period. And then what else do they need for that given sport? Well, you know, what's a sport that you work most common with?
I've worked with baseball players, and probably lacrosse is probably the other one. Seems to have been the biggest two.
Both rotational athletes. Yep. So both that will have high intense efforts, mm-hmm. you know, especially running to first base. If it's a center fielder chasing down a ball with a lacrosse player, especially if they're in the midfield or a forward, sprinting back and forth, mm-hmm. you know, so... What's your foundation when you start them off? Let's say they're in their off season.
Yep.
And you're going to start them off with a program. If we're dealing with periodization training and we're dealing with strength, power, endurance, agility, whatever else, where are you starting them?
So I start most people at my normal kind of set, which is the, you know, most of the stuff we've talked about on here, hip dominant, quad dominant, push, pull, core, something along those lines. And especially with athletes, because the goal for athletes, in terms of performance, mm-hmm. is not necessarily hypertrophy, or it's about function. It's about athletic performance. It's about that kind of thing. So for them, I'm more liable to give, like, one hip dominant, one quad dominant, one push, one pull, one core on one day, and then a different one on, versus somebody who's more hypertrophy, aesthetic,
yep.
lifting based, maybe, you know, an upper lower split, something like that. So for athletes, there's that piece to it. And that tends to be where I start with most people. Athletes, I tend to, especially field and court sport athletes, I definitely tend to lean more unilateral training. Mm-hmm. I definitely have the bilateral stuff in there because, in my opinion, bilateral stuff helps you find kind of your center point, and then the unilateral stuff I build off of that.
Yep.
But if you never know how to do something bilaterally, it's hard to then find the correct spot unilaterally because your body has no sense of center.
Sure.
That's something that I believe I don't necessarily know how true that is, but that's how I've always programmed.
Well, and from the sounds of it, it sounds like you're setting them up with an overall foundation.
Right.
You know, and that, regardless of what it is, generally the foundation needs to come first. So, yeah. You know, even in that case, some people will call it stabilization training. Some people, I mean, a lot of people just get right into it. This is the strength phase.
Yeah.
Whether the first 2 to 4 weeks or have a given emphasis, which may not be specifically lifting at 85 to 90% of your one rep max.
Right.
But you have to set that foundation.
Yeah.
You know, and then from there, it's here's the specificity that we need, because in all of these sports, there's a certain amount of control and strength that we need to then get you to be a better rotational athlete, to get you to be a faster and more explosive athlete. We need strength for the grandmother to squat down and pick up her grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
So again, strength is that individual and specific principle for right. that person in that first phase. And then we can go through and say, okay, well, with this rotational athlete, you know, we need to increase their force output.
Mm-hmm.
So we start working on power.
Yep.
And then now that becomes the more specific goal at that time. So again, all we're looking at are these specific phases with a specific goal in mind to reach our overall goal, which would be, you know, the highest level of performance and injury prevention, because that's also the other thing that we want as well. But that specificity, even if someone said, I want to lose weight. Now, I'm using this as a general term because we know with losing weight, nutrition plays a far more important role in fat loss than actual exercise, but we should still do both. With weight training, now again, I know strength training is very important also for weight loss, like a strength phase.
Yeah.
But generally when people think fat loss or weight loss, what type of exercises do they generally do?
HIIT.
Exactly.
High-intensity interval training.
Correct.
Or, yeah.
So if someone said, my only goal right now is to drop weight,
mm-hmm.
Against better judgment, I'm probably going to give them something high-intense to kind of keep the engine revving, as they would call it. So, and keep it to short bursts. But you can choose that. I mean, pick any specific goal. Let's say it's someone who's rehabbing their shoulder after a rotator cuff repair. Okay, we've gotten you past the phase of physical therapy.
Right.
We now need to progress you into, you know, activity participation, which right. again, you can start to throw. Now we can get you into performance. Now we can throw more. And then, so it's participation, sport, and then performance. So the performance phase is we're at 100% or more, maybe even better than when you got injured. And you can apply that to anything. You know, let's talk about someone who's postpartum, you know, and you know, I want to get my core back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you still have to start them very, very low level.
Yep.
You know, potentially that person's going to be lying on the ground so that they're stabilized but from the floor, and then you can get them up in the standing and then start doing those things. But again, we went way too long in the specificity principle, but we need people to understand that it all goes back to individuality and it all goes back to specificity, regardless of what you're trying to plan.
I think the other important part when it comes to specificity and the individual type stuff is to remember too that a lot of the principles are actually the same. It's how you apply them. You know, you may have, if you have somebody that's, their goal is to get as much muscle mass as possible, with not taking nutrition into the equation, because it's super important for any sort of body transformation, no matter what direction you're going. That person I may have them doing very similar exercises or pretty much the same exercises as the person who's looking for fat loss. The difference is how it's set up. The person who's doing hypertrophy stuff is probably doing more reps and there's more rest, and they're doing more of the same exercise on a given day. Whereas somebody who's doing fat loss may be doing the same exercises, but instead they're doing like a superset.
Mm.
If you don't believe that you can burn more and feel tired and lose fat doing just strength training, try doing some supersets. I'm talking like
brutal.
Yep, do some heavy squats, go directly to a bench press. Do some heavy deadlifts, go directly to a row.
Absolutely
brutal. And just go back and forth. You're going to feel like you just did a HIIT training without having to do 5,000 burpees or whatever, you know?
So, absolutely. It's well, and I think you pointed out the right part, that it's the training parameters that we give someone that really make the difference, you know, and just hearing you talk about that, you know, you're already better at therapeutic exercise compared to 75% of orthopedic physical therapists, because they try to come up with that next circus trick.
Yeah.
You know, the next best thing. They're always, and I appreciate them for their creativity. Yeah. I always tell people, you are only limited by your creativity. But it's kind of like the standing on the physio ball and back squatting. It's like, functionally, unless you're in the circus, what do we ever need that for?
Right.
And what's the risk to reward ratio?
Right.
You know, so that just, I don't know, it always kills me.
Yeah, I tend to think that way when I start seeing people doing things on like a BOSU, which, again, we've talked about this before. A BOSU is a tool that can be used for certain things very effectively. But if somebody can't split squat from the ground, then they shouldn't be split squatting with 1 foot on a BOSU. That's
I agree with that.
That's how I feel about it. If you can't do the base exercise, mm-hmm. then adding stability is not going to make you better.
Sure.
It's just going to create more dysfunction, I think.
Well, and again, I especially, this is just to go back to the BOSU ball. So if someone were to put the blue side down, have the platform side up, and they're doing push-ups off it, great shoulder stability exercise. Great core exercise. Love it. Now, when I see people doing lateral hops onto it and pushing off of it.
Oh, God. I've never even... That scares the shit out of me.
Yeah. So they're push off on their right, land on the left, and then push back off the ball. It's kind of more reactive stabilization, if you want to call it that. The likelihood of someone losing stability and rolling their ankle, very high.
Right.
So, no thanks. But anyways, you know, it's just important for everyone to understand, you know, you can realistically use the same 10 exercises.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you go about adding them into your program, what training parameters are really going to be the big difference.
Yeah.
You know, we've said before, take the same 4 exercises.
I was just going to say,
4 exercises, change your parameters every, we'll even say 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You could literally do the same 4 exercises for all 52 weeks in the year and still get a different training stimulus.
Yep.
You know, and I think 8 weeks would be fine. If you start pushing it, you know, 12 weeks and beyond doing the same 4, I think at that point I'd mentally get burned out.
Right,
exactly. But no, I mean, you start off with the traditional 3 sets of 8, then you can jump into 8 sets of 3, then you can do a 5x5, mm-hmm. then you can do a 6x4, and then you can do a 3x15.
Yeah. We talked about tempo last week. You do the same exercises with a different speed of movement. Oh, you do there's you could legitimately give 100 people the same 5 exercises and have all 100 of them show extremely large progress.
Exactly.
Like, this is not as I don't mean to say this as in like it's crazy simple and anyone who decides they want to be a personal trainer can do it to this level, but it is not as difficult as people make it seem.
Correct.
To create functional programming, or not functional is not the word I'm looking for.
That works progressive.
Thank you. Progressive that works, that gets results. It's really not that. What makes it complicated is trying to keep people mentally engaged and having to fight with people about the fact that they need body confusion or whatever that.
Muscle confusion.
Muscle confusion.
Yeah, Tony. What was his face there? The guy from P90X.
Yeah, I don't remember his name, but yeah.
Tony something. But that also leads us into our next principles of overload and progression. So the principle overload principle really just states that to make adaptations, you constantly have to push your body appropriately beyond its means. So, and then the body will rest and then it gets better and then you can push more. But you have to do that in a step-by-step fashion. Now, is everyone's step-by-step fashion? Is it always linear? No. We've talked about how that's going to change, but you have to do something step by step consistently in order for your body to create that adaptation. So, for example, if we want someone to be better at a heavier squat, for example, and then we can always do it for a power exercise, and let's say they start off with just the bar, 45 pounds, they can move the bar 8 times for 3 sets. They do it, they feel fine, they don't have much muscle soreness 72 hours later. Okay, now we can add 10 pounds. Okay, now we can try getting 3 sets of 10 with 10 pounds on the bar. That feels fine. Then we go up to 20 pounds on the bar. So now we're up to, what was it, 85 pounds? Yeah, 40, 45.
Yeah.
Yeah, 80. Usually if it's less than the 25, I have a hard time counting it. So once we get to 25-pound plates, then it's easier to count. But it's there has to be a... It can't be... The programming and the structuring, the reality of it is if you're a newbie to the game, the weightlifting game, you can really do whatever, and it's a stimulus. You're gonna, the worst program in the world will still create results when you are a newbie. You don't know any better. It's all an adaptation. It's a stress. The body has progressive overload just because it's never done it before.
Right.
You know, everything is step by step as long as you try a little harder. So really, it comes down to effort and intensity. And as long as you want to do it, and that's more of the effort. If you're motivated to do it and you're willing to push yourself 80% or more, you will make changes. Now, when you're into a program or into training as long as we have, it's not as easy to just go do something. There has to be some type of progressive overload, step-by-step fashion. You know, we've talked about before how, you know, I enjoy doing CrossFit. I like it because they give 15 minutes are on the clock, fit in as much as you can. Now, what's other than the whole injury thing, you know, because people always say, well, if you do CrossFit, you're going to get injured. So we'll put that one aside. What's also the biggest, what the hell am I trying to say? When CrossFit gets a bad rap, what do you think the next bad rap is outside of the whole injury thing that has been debunked, but what's the next thing with CrossFit that usually they get knocked for?
In my opinion, they focus too much on volume and not enough on specific exercise, movement patterns, like that kind of thing. Or, you know, the coaching. I don't want it, not that coaching is bad necessarily, but that it's a little bit more focused on just like beating yourself. Not maybe not beating yourself up is a little bit strong, just having a harder time finding a softer way to say it.
You beat yourself up, and they do focus on volume because they look at intensity as work over time.
Yeah.
So, yes, from the outside standpoint, I could see that being a problem. There's one thing specifically, and a lot of strength and conditioning coaches early on really knocked CrossFit for this, and it was basically... Your programs are too variable each time. How do you show progress?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so with progressive overload, really you're paying attention, you're documenting everything, you're documenting the weights that you used. And I can say for the most part, yes, you're not necessarily tracking when you're at CrossFit. I do because I wanna see what I can do. And they do have strength phases that are programmed in. But they have their RX weights, their prescribed weights that they think everyone should do. Me, because I'm a little bit more of a nerd and I want to track my progress, you know, I'll take pictures of all the workouts, track the weights that I'm using. So I'm doing that on my own, but that's nothing that they're doing for me. So I still am creating that progressive overload. You know, now I may not do the same workout for 8 months, but now I can go back and say, okay, this was the weight I used for that given workout. I'm going to do 20 pounds more today and see what my final score is. But it's important to track that. I mean, you do have the people that come in that do the whole auto-regulation. I'm going to do how I feel today. Okay, fine. I can live with that. But over the long term, you need to lift more. You need to do more. You need to be more. What do you do in your programs to track progressive overload?
So, I'll admit that I tend to be someone who
goes... You're the auto-regulator?
Yes. I tend to be somebody who goes based on how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
Because I've never had an issue pushing myself on a day that I feel good.
Yeah.
I will admit that sometimes that gets in my own head. If I'm halfway through a workout and the first two exercises have gone like absolute crap, I sometimes can phone in a little bit on the other ones, but that's more so because I've dealt with injuries in the past, back, knee stuff, and that. So when I feel that, I've come to the point now that I realize that when I feel that way the first couple reps, it means that that day, whether I didn't sleep well, whether I didn't eat enough or ate too much or whatever, when I feel that way, my risk of injury in the past has been higher. Like that, when I felt that way are the times I've hurt myself. But, I mean, when I feel good, I feel good. What I have started doing more recently is I put my training on True Coach, which is what I use for all my clients. I created my own account, so I get my, I get the training that I, you know, made for myself or whatever each day. And I do record my weights on there, and that has been helpful, but I've never had a ton of difficulty challenging myself on a day that I feel good. For me, it's always been, I feel like shit today.
Yeah.
It'll be a win if I go and stay disciplined and get my training in, even if I'm not able to do more today.
Yeah.
Well,
and I'd probably say because of, you know, we calculated last time you have 32 years worth of training. I mean, no, 16 years worth of training. It's easier for you at this point to be an auto-regulator, you know, and probably just by how you feel, you kind of know if you said, all right, today's a strength day, I kind of know approximately where I need to be to hit that overload. But also at the same time, you're also at the point that you can change quickly. So if you started lifting, you're like, today's not my day.
Right.
You would know how to change it to then get a training stimulus.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the important part. Don't just give up. Just, you know, how can we do it? So let's say, for example, you were going to try to squat, we'll just say 315 for easy numbers.
Yeah.
And your goal was to hit 3 reps. You go in, you try your first one, you're like, really not feeling this today. You try a second one, you're like, today's not my day. Maybe you throttle it down to 275.
Yeah.
You know, now it's like, all right, can I hit 3? Maybe I'll do that for 3 sets. And then on my last one, if I still have anything in the tank, I'll try to go for 5.
Right.
You know, now you look at your overall volume and it's like, all right, I still hit the same volume even though I had to adjust my sets, reps, and my weights being used. But again, that takes a very skilled coach or someone who has a lot of training experience.
I think that was one of the cool things that I learned too. I don't remember what program I was doing. It might have been when I was doing the athletic weapons stuff. I feel like it was. It was something. I think it was Pat Davidson thing.
Yeah.
He did some post talking about how hypertrophy is. We tend to think about hypertrophy in terms of just a single set rather than hypertrophy as an overall amount over the course of a training session.
Yeah.
And that was a way I'd never really thought about it before. And when I started to apply that, I actually had some... That has helped me kind of work around that.
Sure.
You know, for that exact way. You know, I'd go in and I'd... You know, the goal was to lift more weight overall over the course of a certain number of sets. So... Let's say that I'm doing bench press with dumbbells. I do 65-pound dumbbells. I'm trying to hit 12 reps. I only hit 10. Okay, so then I go down a little bit, and maybe I hit 14 with 55. And don't quote me on the math. Whatever the case, it still comes out to overall more weight lifted than if I had done another set of 8 with the 65s or whatever I started with.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to recognize when we're talking about volume, it's just overall workload.
Right.
So typically the way you would do this is you would multiply the sets by the reps by the weight, and that gives you some astronomical number.
Right.
You know, some people are like, oh, I lifted, you know, 10,000 pounds. It's like, no, that's overall.
Right.
So in theory, you could drop the weight, increase the sets or the reps, and still hit more for that day. And there are really two training books. One was Maximum Strength by Eric Cressy.
Yep.
You know, when he first came out with that kind of changed the game as far as my programming was concerned. I did it because I wanted to learn about programming, but I also wanted to have a new training program. And that was a great book. And then there was another book called The 531 Method.
That sounds familiar. I can't remember who.
I think it was one of the guys from... what the hell was his name? 531, Build Pure Strength. Jim Wendler.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so that was another one that really showed me the difference with volume. Because the way it was set up was basically you start off your first couple sets at 5 reps, and then you go to 3 reps, and then you go to 1. But then you could also work your way back down and go 5-3-1, 1-3-5. So that way you're increasing your volume, you lower the weight. So between those two books, and then I also read Starting Strength by Mark Ripito.
Yep.
I mean, the guy's just... is an animal. I mean, yeah. Even at his age, I think he's well into his 60s, may even be in his early 70s at this point. He's still squatting 315 for reps. I mean, just way ahead of his time as far as strength is concerned. But that's what they talked about, overall volume and absolute strength versus relative strength. So that's important for people to recognize. You don't always have to go to the gym setting PRs.
Right.
Or at least in the amount of weight lifted. That's the important part. So, but that also goes back, well, you know, for my deload week, I can cut back on the overall weight. I can then cut back on the overall sets. I can still keep the reps where they're at.
Yep.
And I'm still lifting a pretty good volume. Now, is that recommended? No, but it's a way to do it.
Right.
You know, and ideally, if someone's on a 52-week training program, you know, maybe the week before a true deload week. My phone does that all the time, just buzzing all over the place.
I have no friends. Who are they? Who's texting me?
I updated to the new iOS 16, so now for some reason I turned on notifications for everything, so my phone just keeps going off. So I got to go in and change that. But really what you're looking at with a 52-week training program is if you have a planned deload week, you could even start to ramp down into that deload week by changing those sets and reps too and give yourself a little bit more leeway, knowing you're not going to take off any time at all. So... but again, that's all based off of your progressive overload. You know, is this a week that we need to do a step-by-step overload, or is it a step-by-step approach to back off to now physiologically, physically, to mentally give me that rest so I can jump back into it? So that definitely, you know, that was kind of a nice segue into overload and progression. Now, the FIT principle, and we were talking about this before, we completely forgot about that one because I was only going to go with 4 ahead of time. But the FIT principle, so F-I-T-T would be frequency, how often you're actually performing the targeted exercise or physical activity, intensity, how much your effort you're putting into it, how much time you're actually doing it for, and then the specific mode, which would be the type. Now, if we're looking at general fitness, I usually start people with type. You know, what's the important part is you want to do something that you like. So if someone said, I hate weight training, I like walking. If we are initiating an exercise program for someone, just go walk. Do something you enjoy doing. These are the benefits of strength training, and this is why I would highly recommend it.
Right.
But if I'm going to have you do something that you have no interest in doing right now, you're not going to keep up with it. So go walk, go hike, go do this. And you know what? Maybe a month down the road, we'll just throw in a set of squats and a set of push-ups.
Yep.
You know, just see. And then maybe you see, oh, my upper body doesn't feel as bad carrying my pack. My lower body feels better with hiking. Are there more exercises that we can do? Okay, great. Now, the time or the duration... What's your general recommendation, not for an athlete, for just someone who wants to be fit? What's the minimum you would like them to work out, and what's the maximum you would tell them to work out?
So for somebody just doing general fitness type stuff, my minimum, assuming no time constraints or any of that crap, is probably between 45 minutes to an hour. I'm talking total with the warm-up, with the strength training, with the cool-down, the total.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want them probably going over an hour and a half.
I might even have some time.
It might even be an hour 15.
Yeah.
And I don't, unless I'm working with an athlete that has to do, like, has to do sprints and a lift and a cool, you know, and their mobility stuff, I very rarely write training that comes out to longer than maybe 45 minutes.
Yeah, I think the hour and a half for me would also come down to frequency, so how often we're having them train. If someone said, I have a busy life, I can only do 2 days a week, all right, I'm going to give them a little bit more, but then I have to make sure that I'm scheduling it. So let's just use Monday because it's an easy day to always remember, and then maybe Thursday.
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming there's going to be a higher workload, higher intensity on Monday.
Yeah.
I'm going to want 2 full days to recover.
Yeah.
Come back on Thursday, hit it hard again, and then I'm assuming I have Thursday or Friday, Saturday, Sunday to recover, hoping that they do go for a walk, do a light bike ride, go hiking if you want to, kind of active recovery in between. But if someone says, oh, I have 5 days a week that I want to train, we're not doing an hour and a half 5 days a week. I mean, that's a recipe for disaster. And it's just a lot of time.
It is. Let's say I've done a couple programs that involved, like, it would be like tempo sets or something like that on a bike or running, you know, and that takes about 20 minutes. And then I would have, you know, then I would have my mobility stuff, my power stuff. I tried doing the whole thing, and I mean, I felt great, but I was only able to be religious with it for about 3 weeks.
Sure.
And then it wasn't even necessarily that I was like dead beat tired. It was just the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of time, an hour and a half, 4 days a week, never mind five.
Yeah, I mean, I'm even trying to think, because when I was younger, I would always try to design programs where it's, can I do split training mixed with full body training?
Yeah.
So it would be like, again, Monday for an easy day, that's a full body day, Tuesday off, Wednesday upper body split, lower body split on Thursday, Friday off, Saturday full body, then I get a 1 day break, and then I start all over again. In a case like that, then it's, all right, I'm probably going to want high intensity, lower volume on the full body, you know, pick exercises that don't kill me, but I can get the most bang for my buck. Then I can be body part specific with my upper and lower splits, just because I'm only using half the body at that point. And then I could come back on Saturday, again, beat myself up, especially if it's earlier in the day, because I'm assuming I have the rest of the day and Sunday and the early part of Monday to rest up. I don't tend to do that with my training anymore, just because, one, I don't have the time to think about it. But, you know, as we know from a specificity standpoint, it's very challenging to do that. Usually I tell people go all full body or do 4 days of split, where it's 2 upper, 2 lower, or however you want to define it. I just, you know, the mixing and the matching is fun, and I was okay trying it on myself. But, you know, or if someone's just looking for something different, I think that's fine. But what's the goal at the end of the day? Would I give it to an athlete who's 3 months out from their season? No.
No.
Because I'd want to make sure we are specific to what their needs are.
Right.
Now, we talked about type, we talked about time, and then also the frequency. I think another one that we have to pay attention to, and we touched upon this, you know, very early on, intensity, effort. You know, how much effort that someone puts into their program, in theory, is the amount of result that they can expect to see collectively.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are days where it's like, oh, this 2 week span, I've put in 100% and I'm not seeing 100% results. Well, it doesn't happen that quick. But you can expect to see, if you put in 100% effort every day and you stay consistent for 6 months, you are going to be 100% better compared to day one.
Right.
Now, does that mean you are 100% perfect? No, no one is, so we should never try. But again, if you take that effort over the long run, and it's just the law of averages, you don't need to give 100% every single day. Some days I feel amazing when I walk in and I have shitty workouts. There are some days I feel like shit when I walk in. And those are the biggest difference days. You know, I get remotivated once I start working out. The intensity is the most important thing. You know, it's, you know, even if it's not the physical output intensity, again, it's what's the intent with the exercise? You know, you really, when you're at the gym, that should really be the only thing that you're working or thinking about, mm-hmm. you know, and I always call it the mind eraser. I want to be able to only think about that And that's it. You know, that's easy for me to say because it's my hobby and that's what I enjoy doing. So now they talk about heart rate monitoring. I usually don't do that with a lot of people. I know a lot of like endurance athletes will do that.
Yeah.
The metabolic equivalents. Mm-hmm. I don't tend to get into that. No one wants to talk about their Mets. I think of Mets, I think metatarsal bones. So right. When people say Mets, I'm like, what the fuck are they talking about that for? But rate of perceived exertion, you know, that's something that I'll talk to people about. So rate of perceived exertion, you know, is just as it implies. It's how much perceived exertion you're giving at that time. And what they've shown, it's a 10-point scale. And they basically said, if you think you're giving a 7 out of 10, that correlates to 70% of your maximal heart rate. So if you're giving an 8 out of 10, that's 80%. If it's a 3 out of 10, then it's 30% of your maximal heart rate. Where we are on that RPE scale really determines what our progress is going to be over the long run. So when we're training for adaptation or progressive overload, my general recommendation is that, you know, we should be at about a 7 or above, maybe not pushing to a 10. Mm. Because that when we're hanging out at that 10, that's kind of like failure, and that's when we run the risk.
Yeah.
Do you ever talk to people about rate of perceived exertion?
Not a ton. And that tends to be because I don't know. I haven't felt like I've needed to with a lot of people. Usually my way of talking about that is like, not necessarily, I may ask them, how do they feel after this? How do they feel today versus, you know, I'm more liable to use it on a pain. I more often use the pain scale, the 1 to 10 pain. I know that that's a totally different subject. I'm just saying if I'm going on scale, I sure tend to use that with people when it comes to, because I kind of tend to bake it into the way that I write the training.
Yep.
I always tell, like, most of my trainings are a rep range. So I say, you know, you're looking for 3 sets of 8 to 10 reps. If you hit 10, increase the weight a little bit. You're looking to hit 8 or 9 reps with perfect form.
Yep.
So I sort of try to bake the rate of perceived exertion into it.
Yep.
Because if somebody can hit 10 reps comfortably, then I'm looking for them to hit 8 or 9, I know that their rate of perceived exertion isn't as high, or can't think of a way to word that, but they could be doing more than they think they can, so increase it a little bit.
Yeah.
That is, though, what I turn to if I ever have somebody ask, like, how do I know if I'm doing enough? How do I know if I'm this or that? Well, how do you feel during the workout? If you are leaving feeling like, oh, okay, I could have done another 45 minutes, okay, then we need to work harder. If you're leaving feeling like, I'm totally gassed, I'm having a hard time even thinking straight because I'm so mentally and physically fatigued,
yep,
then we know you're probably somewhere up in that upper half.
Sure.
And, you know, not that I necessarily want people leaving that gassed, but
no, but it gives them a good gauge.
Right,
if they do
exactly
it every once in a while,
yeah,
I'd certainly be okay
with
it.
I think
it.
It's a fantastic tool.
Yeah.
I haven't had to use it as often recently, specifically an RPE scale.
And I usually don't feel like people care. I mean, if someone is, so let's say, like right now, long COVID is kind of a, you know, people have the lingering effects of COVID, mm-hmm, and a lot of it's pulmonary stuff. They feel like they have a hard time breathing. Getting them back into a cardio program for cardio endurance,
mm-hmm,
probably the RPE is where I'd want to stay, assuming they're not hacking, coughing all over the place.
Right.
But, you know, let's push it to a 5 today. All right, let's see how you recover. Okay, now let's push it to a 6 on the RPE scale. So I think that's an appropriate way to do it, but I can't say, you know, I usually leave it in terms of, can you do another rep?
Right.
You know, if you can't, you're already at a 10.
Right.
Don't. So, you know, I try to keep it as simple as possible. And then really the last major principle that we have to cover is reversibility. So, and there's some controversy on basically use it or lose it. We're going to keep it as simple as possible. Basically, the reversibility principle states that if you stop doing the specific demand, so strength training, power training, running, you are going to go back to, you know, pretty much your baseline. So we need to keep up with it in some form. Now, the honesty is you may lose the physiologic change. However, there's a neural change that's going to stay present. Your body is going to remember that you once did that. So it's going to be much easier for someone with training experience to get back that specific demand compared to a newbie where it may take a little bit longer, especially if someone's, let's say, a 60-year-old who had 20 years worth of training experience, who maybe took off a couple years, got back into it, the body remembers. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the important part. Now, what people don't recognize is that it happens pretty quickly. You know, the body deconditions. And maybe deconditioning is probably a better word to use than reversibility, but it's all the same principle. We have to maintain it somehow. So, you know, for example, if we're dealing with a strength phase, we may not necessarily have power because we need strength to get to power. Mm-hmm. When we're in our power phase, we may still implement strength-based exercises to try to at least maintain a certain percentage of that. And then once we get into more muscular endurance, if we chose to go that route, then we have to make sure that, you know, maybe a couple sets we're focusing on, you know, 80% of our one rep max just to, again, try to maintain it. So, you know, we never fully abandon something, but it's got to be implemented at the right time. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's important for a lot of people to recognize. Is it perfectly fine to not heavy bench press for 4 to 6 weeks? Yes.
Yeah.
Are you going to lose that much? No. I'm talking 6 months or more of not doing a given exercise. Runners are a great example of this because they're so neurotic about their training. And not just someone who just goes and runs 3 miles. I'm talking runners, half marathons, marathons. Yeah. You know, you ask them to take off 2 weeks to work on their ankle mobility. I'm going to lose everything. I can't. I have to run every single day. It's like, it's 2 weeks. If there's any training loss, it's usually the mental aspect of thinking you are losing training volume.
Right.
So if you may feel slower.
Yeah. But you're going to feel a little rusty.
Yeah. But your actual physiologic change is not going to occur. And studies have shown really it takes about 6 weeks to really lose that from an endurance standpoint. So I usually just say, listen, you know, 2 weeks, that's all I'm asking, 14 days. Maybe we can cut it to 10 and I'll meet you there. But you're not going to just lose everything.
Right.
You know, and then once we fix whatever we need to, you're going to be even better. So you have to look at this as again, a long-term investment.
Right.
So use or lose it definitely is a thing I always look at from a standpoint of physical therapy. Lunging is something that we should all be practicing, and we become bad at lunges because we don't lunge. So then people say, well, I don't lunge on and off the ground because it hurts my knees. Well, was it because lunging was bad for you or because your knees were never conditioned to lunge? And that's where there's the problem. It's like squatting. Squatting isn't bad for your knees. Bad squatting is bad for your knees. Or no squatting.
Yeah. You know,
and altogether. So it's just those simple things that we need to remember. Now, those are the overall training principles that we always think about, even though we don't state them. But if we're going through and we have phases that we worry about, or other, again, we can call them specific principles for a given phase or a program. You know, really stretching, mobility work, dynamic exercises, all of that should really be for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yep.
Really the only time that changes, let's say we have someone who's hypermobile, you know, maybe a younger athlete or someone who has a connective tissue disorder or mm-hmm. something yep. along those lines. You know, we need to think of this as a spectrum, you know, so it's like we have our warm-up. Everyone's going to get a warm-up.
Yeah.
They're not going to be as much on the spectrum of flexibility and mobility as they are. Okay, you're probably going to be more of, let's use facilitation exercises, yeah. or let's load the end ranges under control to make sure that you don't become unstable.
Right.
Whereas you have the person, you know, tight thoracic spine, tight shoulders, tight hips. You're rolling. You are doing your mobility work. You're working on end range mobilizations. But now it's back to the individual and specific principles to that given person.
Yep.
So here we are taking these smaller phases. We have taken these phases and we are now giving them to you because, one, we know a warm-up is good for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
you move too much, so we have to tighten you down. You don't move enough, we have to move you more. Right. So again, that's really just the specificity of it. Now, if we look at progressive overload, I'm usually not too worried about overload as far as really pushing the warm-up, mobility, stuff like that, because really that I want them to save that. However, when we're looking at mobility, end range stretching, if you want to call it that, step-by-step progression, push a little bit more, because we do know we can stimulate the joint at its end range. So, you know, that really focuses on specificity and individuality. Now, once we start to get into like a power or a strength training phase, let's go strength training, because I think this one's a little easier to talk about the way you've implemented it. So when we look at hip dominant, yes, we know the benefit for everyone to do a hip dominant exercise. However, we need to look at the given activity that the person's doing. And I really think about anyone, and because you design more programs at this point than I do, you know, I'll kind of let you answer it. So my question to you is, what information are you looking for to decide this person would benefit from a hip dominant exercise?
Are they a living human being?
Living human being. Yep. What else?
And then I stop there.
That's right.
No, I'm just kidding. But to me, it's more the implement or the way that I go about it, because in my opinion, everyone needs hip dominant exercises.
Correct.
The way that we live today, the amount of, again, we've talked about sitting itself isn't inherently bad. It's the amount of time sitting, blah, 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 blah. I'm not going to get into all that again, but regardless, anything that creates hip extension for most people in today's society is extremely important. Now, how I go about that differs from person to person.
Yeah.
Somebody who has a history of back injuries, hasn't done deadlifts before, hasn't done a lot of training or any training, they may be doing bridges from the floor.
Yeah.
On their back, knees bent, feet flat, drive your hips towards the ceiling.
Yeah.
They may do, and then to make it harder, I may turn it to a single leg bridge. Or,
correct,
you know, put their shoulders up on a bench to give them a little bit more range of motion to increase the... But somebody who's in that state is not going to be doing a barbell RDL to start their program.
Correct.
Whereas somebody who has a history of training, maybe does deadlift or has deadlifted in the past, or I've worked with in the past and I know that they know how to deadlift, blah, 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 they may get some of those other, you know, variations. Or they get, if I'm doing bridging with them, it may be like a shoulders, you know, shoulders on the bench like I would for the other person, but it's a single leg. So they have to control their hip, their lateral hip movement, as well as their hip extension.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to, you know, yes, Gen Pop, are you living? Definitely applies to this. And it's and these are the training patterns we want to see anyways. However, what also we're looking at is what things they have to do throughout the day. So this could be a hockey player. It could be someone who is in construction and is picking stuff up all the time from the ground, or has to stay bent over to, you know, use a nail gun
for
prolonged periods, a roofer. You know, think about those positions that they're in. And that's really no different whether we're choosing hip dominant or quad dominant. Again, do they need, you know, more strength? Do they need more endurance in their quads? But we're always asking specifically and from an individual standpoint, why do you need these patterns?
Right.
So yes, everyone benefits from them, but then based off of the occupation, based off of their hobbies, their activities, the recreational likes, and that's also why we would put that in there. And then same thing with pushing. I mean, in this case, you know, take a offensive lineman.
Yeah.
You know,
right,
blocking, they need to push someone.
Yep.
So that's an easy case that they would need to do something like that. You know, pulling. Everyone should just have good pulling muscles. However, you know, again, the back muscles will usually help out everything else. So, and then strong core, everyone's going to get that as well. So, you know, over time, we found that these patterns work the best for everyone. But we still have to be able, so take a core for example, we'll go back to the lacrosse players that you talked about. If we're only giving them one direction core exercises, we are not maximizing or optimizing their performance. So we have to be able to create rotational power, but also control rotational power. And that, you know, whether it's a soccer player kicking the ball, whether it's a lacrosse player shooting, whether it's a hockey player, whether it's a baseball player throwing or hitting, we need that what we would call transverse plane or rotational plane power. You know, everyone benefits from it, but these athletes, these specific examples, benefit even more because there needs to be a large carryover.
Right.
And then, of course, when we talk about cool down or metabolic work, again, great for everyone. So, you know, really that's just to calm the body down, but that's also a specific demand too. We don't want the body to be jacked up and have a heart rate of 180 for the next 4 hours coming out of the gym. Cool the body down, and again, that's also a principle of recovery too. We didn't even touch upon that, but we've done enough with recovery. I don't think we need to hit upon it there. But is there anything else in the doc that we didn't go over? I know we didn't go over light implement versus heavy, but I think we touched upon it in some capacity.
Yeah, no, I think we're good.
All right.
No, I think we hit pretty much everything.
I think we did too. So hopefully it gives everyone a better idea, or it gives everyone another opportunity to understand why we talk about these things, and hopefully it makes more sense. You know, if you're reading something online, why they're suggesting you do X and Y. It always just comes down to your personal preference, the goal that you're trying to achieve, you know, what access to equipment you have, but keep it simple. You know, that's really the biggest thing. So I think we'll stop there because we'll just start rambling at this point. But you guys know the drill. All of our links to get in touch with us will be at the bottom. Hope everyone has a happy and healthy Thanksgiving. You know, and this is a point where I usually say make sure you eat too much and then nap one too many times. But you know, we're thankful for you guys helping us out. You know, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. So again, thank you for that. And if you guys have any questions or concerns, feel free and reach out, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Take care.